Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we discuss uncertainty. While uncertainty can cause stress, it also acts as a catalyst for growth, creativity, and adaptation. Joining us, psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Social worker Jenny Putnam. Hey, Jenny.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Maggie Jackson joins us, author of Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. Hi, Maggie.
Great to be with you.
All right, so certainly lots of uncertainty causing angst amongst many. And before we get to some of the potential positive, let's start with the impact it can have on our brains. Mark, how does it cause stress? What's happening with uncertainty in our brains?
The best way of understanding this is understanding why it is such a tough mental state to be in and to deal with is evolution. Think of it this way. Humans have been on this planet for a version of humans, at least, for about a couple million years. And we were different from all the other animals, had a bigger brain, and we were smaller, weaker. So if we're going to survive, we got to have some other talents puts us above the people that are above the animals that we would be very good food for. So that has to do with our brain. When the humans first came on, they lived in a very uncertain, but it was a certainly dangerous environment. But it was uncertain as to when the danger would happen, when it could happen. And the humans that survived were the ones that could do something about something that was really dangerous. Run away, hide, whatever. That I think you can look at fear then as the king of all emotions in terms of what we respond to. It gets our attention. If we don't know what's going to happen, and we are. That gets us alerted, first off, and fear takes over. Well, or fear becomes prime, and it can blot out logical thinking because you're so frightened of not surviving. And this has, like I said, evolutionary roots. So it's not something that is, fly by night or a one-off. Yeah. It's indelible. The response is in our DNA, and we're very much wired to respond to it.
So basically, our brain's amygdala, which handles that threat detection, reacts to uncertainty by releasing cortisol, reducing rational prefrontal cortex-driven thinking, right? So it's
all those things.
All those things, right? So, this could be anybody. I'm just wondering your thoughts on, so is this sort of like, especially somebody who's anxious, where uncertainty might be more of a negative in their thinking, is it like that sort of self-fulfilling prophecy? You're worrying so much that you're actually maybe creating some of the negativity that could come from that uncertainty?
Oh, sure. You're less likely to actually respond to something that really is dangerous or really is significant because you're trying to resolve the uncertainty and your brain is kind of looping, is a good term for it. You just worry and ruminate about it so that other stimuli just doesn't register. And it's painful. Mm-hmm. It is exhausting. Uses a lot of energy and also impairs a lot of bodily functions, including the immune system, for instance.
Mm-hmm. So, wait, Mark, are you talking about hypervigilance now?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Hyper, and there's all degrees of hypervigilance, from low to major. And people are, Mindy asked if you're anxious, which is an important concept. People are sort of tuned to be more anxious than others. Mm-hmm. It has to do a large degree with inheritance. DNA transmits it. It runs in, being hypervigilant, being anxious runs in families, mm-hmm. Whether it's a clinical condition or just being more
just
reactive.
More action, yeah. All right, Maggie, you've done a lot of study and work in this area, so I want to hear your thoughts as well.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting and it's so true. When I give talks all over the world, actually, about uncertainty, I give people a little poll at the beginning. Raise your hand, give me one word that comes to mind when I say uncertainty. And the first word, the first hand goes up and people say anxiety. And then it goes fear, and then maybe say doubt. And then there's usually someone who says opportunity in there, which is really interesting. But I think it's very interesting that a lot of new scientific findings find that this response of fear to uncertainty isn't inevitable, because fear definitely lowers your higher order cognition because you're in flight or fight mode. And even I read that blood funnels away from the extremities when you're fearful to the core, and the extremities include the brain, just as Mark was saying. Really fascinating. But at the same time, when people, anxiety is actually defined as fear of the unknown. And so another route to approaching uncertainty, which is being used in clinical psychology, is to lean into uncertainty because, when we go down the path of fear or fearing the unknown, fearing what we don't know, then we go down the road of, being hand paralyzed. But actually, uncertainty is now seen by many scientists as good stress. So you can
That's right.
tap into the without going down to the extreme and being paralyzed and being fearful, you can tap into the arousal, so-called, of uncertainty. It does actually raise your bolster your working memory. It sharpens and focuses your attention. It makes your brain more receptive to new data. So there's this cascading effect that is actually positive, if you can, get past your fear of uncertainty. And that's really, I think, really helpful for people to know. And one way people can do this is to just for instance, I mean, knowing about uncertainty actually helped me understand mindfulness. Because if you are leaning into the moment of being unsure and knowing it's uneasy and not feeling like that's the end of the world, then you're able to understand, the dynamics in the meeting, or see what's going on when you're giving a presentation and you're nervous. A lot of people undermine their performance by focusing on outcome. How am I doing? Am I going to get my bonus? Or, I'm really not doing well. You let those the outcome fixated thoughts cloud your mind, and you are actually not going to be present to the unknowns that you should be coping with. You're focusing on outcome instead of the process. And one great study that shows this is the couple of researchers studied top world-class finals of tennis tournaments like Wimbledon and the US Open. And they found that if the trophy is actually displayed on the court during the finals, the champion, the person who really should knock it out of the ballpark, actually begins to falter. Now, it could be reward-based, greed, but it's often fear of the unknown, anxiety. They're going down that road. So I think it's really great to understand that on the unease of uncertainty isn't a sort of a death sentence, so to speak, in terms of decision making and creativity, et cetera. That's the starting point. It's that good stress of uncertainty that helps you rise to the occasion. And once people know that, they actually can become more positive about uncertainty.
So is this more about being in the moment? Once again, being in the moment is the way to go.
Well,
Is
it's
that I mean, I know that's an oversimplification, but it feels very much like when we focus on the past or the future too much. I mean, we have to think about the future, right? And we have to know ourselves through the past. But when we focus too much on those rather than what's right in front of us, is that right?
I think that from what exactly, because of course you need a goal. If you're giving a high level presentation, you need the goal of getting through your talk and you're doing a good job, and you are not completely abolishing your goals, but at the same time you want to be highly present to the nuances and the dynamism of the moment. And that is what the performance mode of uncertainty is. Uncertainty, and we all know that feeling of when you're in a clinching moment, actually being on your toes. And it's not flow, which Csikszentmihalyi described. It's a little bit different than the flow concept where time stops and you're at the right challenge. It's very related because you have this physiological and this neural response that's really helping you, but it's still uneasy because it's not routine. It is not ease. It is not comfortable sitting on your couch and not being challenged. It's uncertainty is really all about non-routine situations. It very much puts you, I have really benefited from learning this sure. In terms of, helping me in clincher situations.
Go ahead, Jen.
Yeah. And so my follow-up question, which, full disclosure, I asked you before this show started, is what about those moments when you're feeling uncertain, but you have no power to make a difference? So I'm thinking about the world right now,
right.
You think about climate change, let's say. And so it feels very much like I'm powerless to do anything.
Yes. And I think that's such a great question because I get mail from, people with stage 4 cancer. And I told you before the show, I spoke to the National Cancer Institute, a laboratory about patient communications and uncertainty. And and basically there are two kinds of uncertainty, even though there are lots of different types of uncertainty in economics or medicine or, engineering, or we have different vocabularies, but they're kind of two basic kinds. There's basically the unknown, the volatility, the unpredictability, and that's, we call it the uncertainty, and that's what humans can't fully know. So you might have fantastic predictable models telling you what's going to happen with that hurricane, but we really don't know where it's going to hit and what damage it'll do. So that's the uncertainty. It's called aleatory. And then there's our epistemic uncertainty, our unsureness, literally. And that's basically not full-blown ignorance, but when you're thrust into that new, unknown, ambiguous, or unexpected situation, then you reach the limits of your knowledge. And that's how uncertainty is defined now. You're caught short, hence the unease, hence the stress response, and yet you're working at the edge of what you know. So if you think about, some overwhelming unknown or something that happens that, you lost your job, one of these life situations, when you can feel a little more skillful about your uncertainty, because you're caught short, but yet it might be this, it might be that. Uncertainty is a space of possibilities. That's another phrase that a lot of different scientists use just coincidentally. You might do this, you might do that. Well, again, we don't want to remain in that limbo, but the uncertainty is actually allowing you to approach the unknown. It really is, I think, one of humanity's great faculties for approaching the unknown. And if all great achievements, as William James said, are based upon the courage of a maybe, which is great.
Tell us about the conversation with the Cancer Institute. What did they tell you about communications with patients?
Well, I was just talking about, some of the research I've done in and around medicine, but also other disciplines. Patient communications, the doctors here will know more than I on the front lines, but, because medicine for so long has been aimed at, as is business, as is politics, because we in our society have valued certainty and quickness and sureness and linked that with success. And the smart guy is the one who comes in and knows what just to do. Because of this, both patient and doctors have kind of built up a system, especially in the past, where the doctor handed down the information from the kind of Olympic mountaintop of their expertise, and then the patient, took this and carried it forward, whatever. Things are a lot more complicated now, but the good news is that in cancer and in many other aspects of medicine, uncertainty is now seen as a positive, both for patient and doctors. Intolerance of uncertainty, which is a a personality trait, which I also really want to mention a little more about. But anyhow, being threatened by uncertainty versus seeing it as a challenge and working with it, people who are threatened in the medical profession and the healthcare profession are much more likely to have burnout and anxiety. So mm-hmm. a lot of effort now to get doctors and healthcare professionals to work with uncertainty, not hide it, to not feel as though it's a disaster if the resident says, I don't know. And doctors in Maine are being trained on this. And far as patients are concerned, you know, I think that the communication, if a doctor says, well, you've got stage 4 cancer, I don't know, and leaves the room, well, that's horrible. No one would want that. But what skillful uncertainty is developing a language. And there are now studies that show, for instance, if an expert admits uncertainty and yet links this to possibility, then communications are really strengthened and there's more persuasion, actually. So that would be the doctor coming in and say, at this point, I'm not sure of exactly the treatment, and yet we're consulting two other world experts. And you can see, you know, there's a mm-hmm. complexity there, which mm-hmm. allows both sides. And doctors also have told me, and psychologists who have begun to understand this new science of uncertainty, that not only is it liberating to get past the fear, but they also say that helps them turn into partners in care.
That's right.
Yeah.
Beautiful image.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about uncertainty this morning with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, social worker Jenny Putnam, and Maggie Jackson, author of Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before the break, Mark, you wanted to chime in?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention something, and we could go back and forth on this, the uncertainty really proves to be an Achilles heel of humanity, especially in the political scene. I think one of the reasons that Trump has been successful, and at least with a lot of voters, and kept them under his spell, is that he seemed, what they would say is, he tells it like it is. He's certain. He's certain all the time about things, no matter how fanciful it might be. It doesn't matter. He comes across as a strong, authoritarian, certain person. That's appealing. And Hitler was like that as well. That's one of the, that tells us how we can put aside logic and go for the what appears to be a strong leadership, someone who certainly knows what to do.
Yeah.
It would be so nice if we had more of a, this is sort of a new science as I'm understanding it. And it's too bad, because it would be nice if we had a historical perspective. It does feel very much like certainty gets closed off now really quickly, and increasingly people can't tolerate it, much mm-hmm. like people can't pay attention to things longer. And yeah. so I would be curious to what degree things like the environmental disasters that we're seeing, the big fires, the big snowstorms, mm-hmm. the big flooding, mm-hmm. To what degree that level of uncertainty where we can't do anything is making us want more certainty in other right. areas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting what Maggie was saying about, in the field of medicine, it is kind of classically a bit of a joke. What's said about surgeons, that the sort of textbook surgeon's personality is always certain, not always correct, but always sure of themselves. And when you are talking with a surgeon about whatever they just found after opening you up, you want him or her to sound like they know what they're doing. You want them to sound like they are pretty clear on what just happened and what the future holds in store. Of course, you want them to be correct also, but outside of the OR, In personal life, that trait can really be freaking annoying to a lot of other people.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay. I spent time in Toronto, Canada, embedded in the operating room. It probably wouldn't happen in the States, but I was like 3 feet from the patient with standing on a stool with my tape recorder. I observed multiple operations along with this fantastic hepatobiliary surgeon who studies surgical judgment, because we were studying, because, you know, I was up there to ask, well, when the surgeon is in the middle of a crisis in the operating room, would you want him or her to be unsure? And they score, as you're right, Jonathan, the highest on personality tests among the different healthcare providers of that intolerance of uncertainty. And partly it's performative. They have to be in the theater. And, you know, in the middle of one operation, this surgeon made what he thought was, he was doing a liver resection to take out the cancer and cancerous half of a liver. He thought he cut the bile duct, which is what patients usually can't survive. You know, it was a huge dramatic moment in the operating room. And the problem was he treated it as if it was all routine. I mean, one of the other fantastic, advances in our research about expertise, you know, and uncertainty has to do with discovering who is the person who can cope in a crisis. You know, as I said, uncertainty is not for the routine, and people who can cope are called adaptive experts. They actually wade into the question, even in the middle of a crisis in the operating room. They take time to look at multiple options about what's going on and what's going wrong. They test them, I mean, all in a few minutes. And this has shown to be, these are the people who can actually perform at the highest level in uncertain situations by wielding their uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I was going to say to Mark, as you would agree, I think that the problem with, I mean, the authoritarian's playbook is to sow uncertainty and fear of uncertainty while performing as the certain person, right. Which is why our president is so erratic, because when you are certain, you get blindsided by the unknown because you're not being adaptable to it. Right. But basically, the problem is with our society and our ideas of quick certainty as being, the best recourse in challenging times. And that's where I think I see a lot of hope, although, these new ideas of uncertainty as positive, uncertainty as skillful, are new, and there might be at the margins, but the word is spreading. And in AI, in medicine, in engineering, in clinical psychology, I literally have read journal articles from organizational management that said, the headline was, "Why haven't we been talking about uncertainty?"
You're going to love this email. Right? This is from Eleanor in West Tisbury. She says, "One of the most exciting things for me about being an artist is the uncertainty aspect. People in this field have to have a high tolerance for chance, and some of us use that element of surprise as part of our daily working method. A professor of mine in graduate school had one of the lowest tolerances I've ever seen in an artist. He insisted on control and mapped out his canvas like a paint-by-number kit, but the behavior of art materials, brushes, paint, mixing oils was never entirely predictable and drove him absolutely crazy. For me, surprise is the magnet drawing me into my studio every day. It's in uncertainty that the possibilities are endless. Wonderful program and very interesting topic." Thank you, Eleanor, for the email. If you'd like to send us an email.
Amen. That's beautiful.
thepointatcapeandislands.org, or you can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. There's she's got a good point. In art, that is, it's all about surprise and uncertainty, isn't it?
Gardening, sure. Too.
Yes.
Parenting.
Yes. Well, parenting. Goodness, yes.
Uncertainty is a fact of life. It's a, phenomenon for which there is no alternative other than death, right? Mm-hmm. But I like the idea of pairing the notion of resilience with the fact of uncertainty. Because really, teaching our children our resilience or our patience or whoever, you know, to me, to a large degree, is a matter of learning how to thrive with uncertainty, right?
Right.
Thriving with uncertainty accomplishes or is resilience.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, you make me think also about ability to tolerate other people. So I don't know about you guys, but when you're, right? When you're in a practice with patients, so often they come in saying, but people are supposed to behave this way. There's no predicting how people are going to behave.
Right.
Right. Of course, and then you have psychiatrists who are at the opposite end of the spectrum from the surgeons, because we never know what the hell is going to happen.
Exactly.
That's a good thing.
Exactly.
Well, I think it's a good, I'd love to return to that notion of tolerance of uncertainty, because this was discovered in the post-war era by a Berkeley psychologist who was working with a bunch of very leading lights, including Adorno, to understand the authoritarian personality. So they wanted to understand why people followed, you know, Hitler and Nazis. And so Elsa Frankel Brunswick discovered through giving people sort of tests of their, you know, ability to deal with change, basically. In fact, it's worth describing briefly. She would show people cards. They were just pencil drawings. At the first card was a cat, clearly a cat. And then over the course of these card after card after card that she would show people, it gradually, with these little changes to the tail or the muzzle, turned into a small dog. Well, there was a certain number of people who she had, and then she would ask them, is this a cat? Is this a cat or a dog? Is this a cat or a dog? All the way along the line, people would change their minds and say it was finally a dog. And so finally but there were a certain number of people who she said who had a tendency to, quote, escape into the definite. They could not budge. At the very end, they were still saying cat, cat, cat. And she labeled this tolerance of or intolerance of uncertainty. Right. And so now it's really picking up speed. And basically it all comes down to, we all sit somewhere on the spectrum of being intolerant or tolerant. People who are intolerant of uncertainty dislike surprise. You know, they are rigid thinkers. They are see it as a threat. You know, one podcaster interview actually once said to me, what do you do with the anger around uncertainty? And I was going, angry, anger. You know, he was really not tolerant of uncertainty. But now psychologists led by Michel Dugas up at the University of Montreal, I believe, are working on these very advanced treatments for anxiety just based on exercises to help people bolster their tolerance of uncertainty, because we can actually move the dial and become more tolerant through simple daily exercises. And basically it's based on exposure therapy. They found that by helping people, you know, try out a little of the unknown every single day, like delegate more at work or try a new dish in a restaurant or very simple things, they were actually in 12 weeks took people with intractable anxiety like GAD and, helped them. Their worry levels fell after 12 weeks of tolerance of uncertainty treatment to the level of the general population, which
wow.
is, yes, stunning. Yeah. And so he's doing this amazing work and it's going all over the world. But we can all do this, you know, simple daily exercises, just, try out the unknown, go on the blind date. In Ohio, they're working with high schoolers to boost their tolerance of uncertainty to help them be more resilient. And what they're, one of the exercises literally is to answer your cell phone without caller ID. And the kids are terrified of that.
Yeah, so interesting.
This is making me think of a book, a series. Octavia Butler is a Black sci-fi writer. She's dead now, but her books are amazing. And she writes a series, I think it's the Sowers series, but I'm not sure. I've read all her series, so I'm not positive, where a religion is formed and the basis of the religion is the only certainty is that everything changes. And so I think of that I read that book probably 25 years ago. I think about it all the time. Because it's true. That is the only thing that we know, is That's everything right. always changes.
Right. That sounds like Buddhism.
Well, the main thing we need to start with is don't be so allergic to it. Like we were just saying, except if you're going to be alive, you're going to be uncertain. Accept it.
But we know people don't
that's being
like
alive.
People don't like change, right? So I mean, that's very difficult for people. And Maggie, it's something you get into in the book, that study shows just being willing to accept change makes us more alert to the shifts in the fabric of life, right? So even just starting with that, being willing.
Exactly. That change, that mental, that's why people say that when they begin to learn about the positive someone's being unsure skillfully, and that there is skill involved, then they call it liberating. And I think one important point also in this whole mix, fascinating mix about uncertainty, is to understand that it's not monolithic. Because, you know, again, we sort of bandy around that word and don't really define it in daily life, and don't really distinguish between the uncertainty out there and our unsureness. But also, you know, there's so many fascinating ways in which uncertainty is woven into our life and can be therefore harnessed. You know, a daydream, a creative daydream, the artists will know all about this, is a what if question. It's more of a thought experiment than the mind wandering classically about, you know, being hijacked by your mind and, you know, kind of going where you don't really want to go and being, you know, so historically people treated, scientists treated daydreaming as a no-no, you know, it's a basically you're off task, so to speak, but actually your mind is helping you be on task to some inner problems and go and work through things. And also the what if possibility, the uncertainty of the daydream allows you to explore the space of possibility. People who are more creative actually are able to work through different categories of a problem. You know, classic test is, you know, what are the alternate uses for a brick or a shoe? And the creative people will go far flung and make all sorts of wild and wonderful creative suggestions, because they are looking perhaps at the shoe or the brick in terms of its form, in terms of its parts, in terms of its texture, its terms. So they're switching categories is really highly related, and that's working with uncertainty in a positive way. So that uncertainty can be tolerating that person whose politics you loathe, you know, next door. It can be that crisis decision making. It can be all, you know, uncertainty. We can be skillfully uncertain in so many different areas of life.
Yeah, you mentioned the daydreaming. I just want to bring this up. In your book, you write about this biomedical engineer who instituted these tech-free Friday mornings to his production team of like 30-odd scientists to read deeply, to interact in real time, and most of all, to daydream. Hi, boss. I'm here. Okay, now go daydream. I just loved that. And he gets results.
Yeah, Jim Collins, he's now at Harvard, I think. It might be MIT, I should remember. But anyhow, he's a synthetic biologist. He is absolutely a genius MacArthur genius, literally, and his inventiveness in inventing cures for Ebola. He invents some of the newest first antibiotics in 35 years. I mean, his work ranges, but he sets time for daydreaming, and he asked his huge lab of young people to do this, and literally, I visited at the time, this was a few years ago, there was a mutiny. I asked them, when he wasn't in the room, do you not believe that this is useful for, you know, his genius work, or do you not know how to do it? And they said, we really don't know how to do it. We really don't know what it means to step away from the computer and be within our own minds. And then I tracked one fellow down 5 years later, and he was beginning to pick up the habit and find that he talked about this categories, you know, moving between categories is kind of moving. He said, you can be in the valleys of a problem, but then when you ascend to the mountain and move between mountains, and, you know, I call daydreaming controlled drift, which is the uncertainty, but it's also you know, you are guiding it to where, you know, they think about their scientific problems, not what they're, you know, eating for lunch. So, he was an incredibly inspiring person.
We're talking about uncertainty. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing uncertainty this morning with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, social worker Jenny Putnam, and Maggie Jackson, author of Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So, Mark, you sent along some notes on our topic today, and this Professor Leahy, who I'm not sure where he's from, but I love some of the stuff he says here. He says, people underestimate their ability to cope with a bad situation. You can't say, don't worry and everything will turn out fine. People will think you're an idiot. But there's productive worry and unproductive worry. Productive worry is thinking about something you can do in the next 24 hours. Unproductive worry, on the other hand, is fretting about whether the stock market and the entire economy will decline by 25%, something you can't do anything about. That's just so spot on, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's being able to accept you can't control things. You can't have everything certain. And you're better off going with the flow, so to speak, and not trying to control everything, because you will wear yourself out. You know, the extreme form of psychopathology regarding uncertainty is obsessive compulsive disorder. Those are people that simply can't accept anything being uncertain. They'll even take a picture of the door being locked, it tells them that they locked the door, that they don't have to come back and check it again. They still will go back and check it. So that's the extreme. And there's some definite tracks in the brain that are underactive or overactive. So it's basically a brain-derived disorder. But it's an extreme example of what is basically normal. We live in a society or environment that can't be controlled.
Right.
Life isn't like that.
Yeah, I want to go back to anxiety for a second, because I'm thinking there might be people listening to this who are going, this all sounds great, but it's, you know, everything's so overwhelming, especially everything we're talking about, the world, it just seems like everything's so, it's so much at once, right? And for somebody who has anxiety, they may intellectually understand, you know, this isn't rational maybe, but it's very hard to control, right? So what are your, what are your thoughts on people who might be in a situation like that, who are going, I'd like to be able to do this? Some first steps. What are some things? We talked about just being open to change, but what are some things you would say to those folks who just really have a lot of anxiety right now?
Take a deep breath.
I would say first. Try different things, though. Go ahead, Mark. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, take a deep, do something to distract yourself from the ruminating. And taking a deep breath, walking in nature, we always recommend that because it roots you again in the present and roots you again in being alive. And it's also, you can be awed by what nature has, what nature is with being alive. And that's what's really important in living.
And that going into nature, I have to say, that's also, you don't know what you're, I say this to my grandson all the time, you want to take a walk? We don't know what we might find. Right? Unexpected.
Right. Yeah. It's also really important for people to stop watching the news. Americans.
Or 24/7 anyway, yeah.
I mean, it's the addictiveness, the addiction to the news, which is such a global, or at least certainly universal American phenomenon, is to me hard to understand. Sometimes we should do a program on why is it that people need to watch the news, you know, twice a day, every day, and catch up on the most recent disasters, particularly when one considers that it's the job of every newscaster to be as sensationalistic as possible in order to attract the most eyeballs.
Are we talking TV news here? Because I don't think we do that, Jonathan.
No. There are a lot of good journalists.
We're specifically
out
talking
there.
About TV news.
Okay.
Yeah. We're specifically talking about TV news, which is what I think what most people routinely use in addition to newspapers or radio.
People of a certain age.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, this is an interesting topic to me. Maybe we can talk about this because I certainly, and I'm the biggest advocate of stop watching the news. However, my father and my husband, so obviously I'm going to marry someone who's similar to my father, they need the news. Like they feel better. Their anxiety feels better if they're watching the certain news. Well, my dad watching, my husband listening, and they would say they feel like they're part of a like-minded community when they watch or listen to those things, and that helps their anxiety and their sense of aloneness with the unknown. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I say try different things, because I'm very struck by the difference between how my husband deals with the uncertainty and how I do. Yeah. So I get very local. I get
Jenny, local. Your husband and your father need help. Okay. that's pretty clear.
No.
I don't think that's true.
I know a good therapist I can recommend.
Oh, yeah. I think my father is actually, and my husband both are very healthy in this respect. I don't know how they do it. I have another friend. I do also think the news obsession trends towards men rather than women, but that might just be my circle. But I know another man in New York City who is another one of these obsessive news followers. And I have watched him just get more and more and more and more and more and more anxious.
And it doesn't come down to, I mean, you know that. I mean, if you're one who watches the news and makes you anxious, you know that about yourself, right? So maybe those are the people who need to back off a little news or find different news outlets, right?
Yeah.
And I guess just knowing, you know, what your anxiety, you know, producing things are.
One of the another Canadian scientist who studied uncertainty quite a bit, Nicholas Carlton, and has developed some of this work on tolerance of uncertainty, has found, I mean, it's correlation and you have to take it with a grain of salt, but he's found that as the rise of cell phones came into being for years, young people grew more intolerant of uncertainty.
Sure.
He talks about how the checking, 150 times a day, it's not just the news, like checking your phone, which is giving you this stream of like neat, quick, pat little answers, is actually correlated to the kind of, mental challenges, mental diagnoses related to like needing to be assured all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
that's right.
That kind of checking. Yeah. And I'd say for people who are anxious about the state of the world, which is very realistic, but remember that anxiety is a fear of the unknown. And the one good thing is that incremental work, as is shown by these treatments related to intolerance of uncertainty, incrementally coping is actually doable. Mm-hmm. And so one of the great things about these daily exercises, that these assignments are, that they're pretty small things. Try a new dish in a restaurant. When I read about that, I thought, oh, come on, ha, ha, ha. How's that going to boost your tolerance of uncertainty? And then I think on a Friday night, go to the restaurant, same restaurant, I want that clam spaghetti or whatever it is I had, or, do I do mocha chip all summer for my ice cream flavor? Yeah. Basically, I feel as though, there are these wonderful little ways to sort of bite off a little more of the unknown. And then the great thing is you're utilizing surprise, because we all live anticipating and expecting. We're prediction machines. Our brains
that's
are
right.
thinking that we're going to be, it's going to be the same, because that's how we can move through life, because my office is in the same place and my coffee cup is in the same place. And I can expect that the things will be pretty similar. But surprise is a prediction error in the brain, which is highly related to that good stress of uncertainty. And so if you seek prediction error, you seek surprises incrementally within, at the edges of your comfort zone, then you're teaching your brain that surprise is not a disaster, but that it comes in many different flavors, so to speak.
Yeah. I think we can all agree that the worst kind of uncertainty is the uncertainty we experience when we can't find our phone and where is my phone?
Well, you know, it's funny because you ask a young person why they don't. I'm thinking of a relative. I'm like, why don't you answer your phone? Well, I don't know what you're going to say.
Wow.
Like, why are you calling? What are you, they'd rather get it in the text form than hear whatever question or, you know, why you're calling. Because it could be something bad, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So it kind of speaks to that. Well, yeah. I know.
Humans are the great unknown, as James said.
Before we run on, we have a few minutes left, Maggie, but I want to make sure you get to talk about your Uncertainty Walking Book Tour. So tell us about that.
Yes, I'm doing a Uncertainty Walking Book Tour in Tiverton at the Four Corners, Tiverton Four Corners, on Saturday, April 25th, 2 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. This is hosted by the Yellow House Bookstore, fabulous bookstore there. And basically a walking book tour is a British invention. The South Coast Almanac locally does them periodically. And it's an author-guided walking tour that basically is aimed at bringing your book to life. And so basically, you know, we're going to be talking about the concepts about uncertainty, some of which we mentioned today, getting past your fear of the unknown, etc., but through local history and places. And I'm going to tell a great spy story from the Revolutionary War, and we're going to go to a graveyard, and we're going to talk about why knowledge is not set in stone. And so please come. It's going to be a great afternoon, and there'll be snacks and a coffee shop at the Yellow House, and it's free and free open to anyone.
All right. Just, we still have a couple minutes left. Some final thoughts on uncertainty. Anybody want to chime in?
I just, when she said graveyard, I was thinking about how many people in my life and in my practice have talked as if death were an uncertainty.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh,
like,
sure.
Like avoiding the knowledge that death is a certainty.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's how people, what they use denial is more than just a river in Egypt. It helps to deny death so that you don't have to be so afraid of lack of non-existence, basically, which is terrifying.
But considering we really don't know what happens in and around after you
die. The afterlife, yeah.
There is uncertainty in death. Maybe the timing isn't in our control. And also look at the fantastic studies now about consciousness in people who were considered vegetative. And that expands our understanding of what quote unquote death is. And I think that's really fascinating. The only last thing I'd like to throw out there is if anybody's going to remember anything about uncertainty, they should remember, please, that uncertainty is wisdom in motion.
What a great way to end it. All right.
That's good.
Maggie Jackson's author of Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. Social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz, psychiatrist Mark Willey. As always, thank you all for being here and sharing your expertise. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.